This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Kay Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post, reading from the March-April issue and beginning with Everyday Heroes by Ken Budd. Seven lessons from everyday heroes. What I've learned from ordinary yet extraordinary people about kindness, compassion, and helping others. My first Everyday Heroes column began with a suicidal veteran named Blade. He had served as a Marine Corps medic for an artillery unit in Iraq, and after returning home to California, he struggled with PTSD, nightmares, alcoholism, and sudden rage. "I need someone to love me," Blade told a suicide hotline. The next day, he applied for a companion dog with Pets for Vets, a nonprofit that pairs animals with veterans. Blade was matched with Dee Dee, an abandoned pit bull Labrador mix. All of Pets for Vets' animals are rescued from shelters, and the bond was instantaneous. Dee Dee was trained to wake Blade during nightmares, and her presence soothed him. "Dee Dee saved my life," Blade said. Pets for Vets was founded by animal trainer Clarissa Black. She was the first person I profiled back in 2018, and I was moved by her compassion, her vigor, and the joy she felt from her work. "I love seeing the smiles on the veterans' faces and the happy body language of the dogs," Black said. "One gentleman told me that he had lost his heart and soul in Iraq, but his dog helped him navigate the minefield of his emotions. He was able to love again." I've profiled 28 people in this column, and my response is always the same. I feel blessed. Blessed to hear their stories of generosity and love. Blessed to witness their empathy. Blessed to feel a warm slice of the light they share with the world. As we begin our sixth year of Everyday Heroes, these are the biggest lessons I've learned. 1. We're stronger than we think. Over the past few years, I've faced some challenges. I'm in the middle of a divorce. I had a heart attack. I sought help to address childhood issues I concealed my entire life. Throughout my journey, I've been inspired by the steely resilience of the people I've profiled. In 2022, I interviewed skier Roy Tuscany, who suffered a devastating spinal cord injury after crashing on the slopes. 3 nights after the accident, consumed by pain, Tuscany told his mother that he wanted to die. "I didn't raise a son to say those words," she said. "Don't you ever say those words again." Her resolve and unconditional love helped spur Tuscany's recovery. He relearned to walk and started the High Fives Foundation to assist others recovering from life-altering injuries. Frequently, Tuscany visits patients at their bedside. Roy goes into the hospital, into the ICU, and he lifts up people that have these hard experiences, said Becca Lefenowicz, the foundation's director of fundraising and media. He tells them, "Hey, life might not be the same, but it can still be awesome." 2. Generosity can ignite hope. When someone feels cared about, you can change the entire direction of their life. Paul Kakamo told me that in 2020, Kakamo is the founder and CEO of Up to Us Sports, which trains young adults to be coaches in low-income communities. "Up to Us coaches," he said, "send a message to kids. Regardless of what happens on this field, on this court, in this ice hockey rink, I care. And I'm going to care tomorrow, and I'm going to care next week." When children hear that, it's amazing how it changes their view of themselves, he said. Rick Ackow sends the same message to homeless individuals in Baltimore. On weekly Selfless Saturday events hosted by his organization, Generosity Global, roughly 400 people eat a hot meal, shower in a truck equipped with private stalls, sift through racks of clothes, and receive haircuts, toiletries, drug counseling, job advice, and mental health services. Ako understands their plight. During a rough patch in his life, he lived in his car for 3 months. "It's dignity restored," Ako said of the services. "People have hope again because they know that someone actually cares." 2. Everyone has potential. When he was a teenager, Orrin Hudson committed petty crimes. Then a teacher taught him to play chess, and he was hooked. Hudson became the first African American to win the city chess championship in his hometown of Birmingham, Alabama. These days, he teaches chess at Ask Risk Children through his nonprofit, Be Someone. The goal is to instill the same qualities in kids that he learned from chess: discipline, focus, curiosity, patience. "I tell children, when I look at you, I see me," Hudson said. "I was just like you, but here are some things I did differently, and you can too. If I can do it, you can do it. No one is better than you. If we make smart moves, we can get great results." 4. You can reinvent your life. Darren Cockrell's trials began in childhood. When he was 4, his father was murdered. At age 6, with his mother addicted to crack, he entered the foster care system. By age 10, he had joined a gang. "When I think back, it's crazy how many times I see myself sitting alone crying because I felt like my life was nothing," he said. And yet, through brains, resolve, and the help of pivotal people at pivotal moments, Cockrell entered college. In 2020, he was named Missouri's Teacher of the Year. Carl Ombly transformed himself at a later age. For decades, Ombly worked as an auto mechanic and owned multiple repair shops. But as a child, he wanted to be a doctor, and the dream persisted. So, Ombly sold his business and went to med school, trading leaky carburetors for clogged arteries as an emergency medical physician at the Cleveland Clinic. His age when he graduated from med school, 47. 5. Small moments can have big impact. Our everyday heroes do incredible work, but many are accidental activists, as Dana Marlowe once told me. Marlowe is the founder of I Support the Girls, which distributes bras and feminine hygiene products to homeless shelters and organizations worldwide. Its origin story: after losing 35 pounds, Marlowe had gone bra shopping and asked the clerk about donating her old bras. "Homeless women need bras," the woman told her. So an inspired Marlowe contacted a local shelter and learned that people rarely donate socks, underwear, or bras. She later met a homeless woman who hadn't received a new bra in 30 years. "It was a turning point," she said. "I didn't know that homeless women needed bras, which made me think, what else don't I know?" Until she was a junior in high school, Julia Warren didn't know that many low-income children in her home of Richmond, Virginia, had never celebrated their birthday. At age 16, she created the nonprofit Celebrate RVA, which has hosted hundreds of birthday parties to make kids feel special. Pat Craig was 18 when he saw surplus lions and tigers, likely to be euthanized, confined to small cages at a Florida zoo. That one moment changed his future. Over the past 40 years, his organization, the Wild Animal Sanctuary, has rescued more than 1,000 such large carnivores, plus wild horses, and given them space to roam on 4 properties in Colorado and Texas. 6. Sacrifice can lead to satisfaction. Launching a nonprofit isn't easy. It requires determination, long hours, and of course, money. Chief Bill Bracken invested his life savings to launch his California nonprofit, Bracken's Kitchen, and gave up a career in posh restaurants to feed those in need. The work, however, satisfies my soul, he said. Others juggle full-time careers with humanitarian endeavors. Temi Nablock Baronin, M.D., is a surgeon in Kansas City, and in her free time she performs pro bono operations in countries such as India and Mali as the co-founder of One Global Village. John Alex is a successful financial advisor in New York City who founded United Aid Foundation, an international relief organization. Alex and UAF frequently work in horrific conditions, whether in post-earthquake Haiti or the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian, which Alex compared to photos of Nagasaki after World War II. And yet, when I traveled with UAF to Mali in 2019 and watched him and his fellow volunteers on a building project in a remote village, I knew that he preferred the heat, dust, and wandering chickens over any air-conditioned day on Wall Street. I get anxious when life isn't being lived, he told me. And 7. Kindness is everywhere. One of my favorite Everyday Heroes pieces focused on Mary Latham, a wedding photographer from Long Island. When I met Latham in Maryland in late 2019, she was in year 3 of a quest to collect stories of kindness in all 50 states. The road trip was inspired by her mom, who died in 2013. After the 2012 shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut, Latham's mother had said, "Mary, there are always going to be tragedies in the world, but there will always be more good. You just have to look for it." Which is what she did. As she crisscrossed America in her late mother's Subaru, Latham documented kindness both small and large. One of her favorite stories involved a bank teller in Rhode Island. The teller was having a rough day, and a customer asked if she was okay. "It's nothing some M&Ms won't fix," she said. 30 minutes later, the customer returned and slid a bag of M&Ms under the teller's window. "I love telling that story because that's something we can all do," Latham said. "A bag of M&Ms. We feel like an act of kindness has to be big, but it can be buying someone a cup of coffee or just smiling more." By seeking kindness, Latham inspired kindness. Mechanics who heard her story volunteered to service her car. Her GoFundMe campaign raised close to $30,000 to cover expenses. Strangers invited her to stay in their homes. Michael Kesnell was leery when his wife asked Latham to stay at their home in Ohio, but the experience, he said, was transformative. "I found myself looking for more good based on Mary's mom's promise that it's out there, and he has found it, spotting kindness that he admits he would have otherwise missed." That's also what we're doing with this column, revealing kind acts and kind people in an often divided country. I look forward to sharing more stories of everyday heroes. To find the entire collection of Ken's Everyday Heroes stories, go to SaturdayEveningPost.com. Ken Budd has written for The Atlantic, The Washington Post, National Geographic Traveler, and many more. He is the author of The Volunteerist. Backstory by Mark Orwall. Save the Rails. America's oldest narrow-gauge railroad is back from the brink of doom for a second time. Burly scrap dealer Nick Kovacic, 50, could hardly believe what he'd just bought. 6 steam locomotives, some still warm to the touch, dripped oil and collected dust in a turn-of-the-century roundhouse. Vintage coaches and hopper cars reposed on sidings, creaking in the breeze. A Victorian-era steam-powered belt-driven machine shop begged for action in the dusty cathedral light of its silent interior. Scattered elsewhere in the complex were decades-old storage sheds, a 19th-century carpentry shop, a foundry, maps and posters and paperwork going back to the railroad's construction in 1872, a 1790s-era stone farmhouse, and a cute-as-a-button train station. The year was 1956, and Nick Kovacic had just walked into a Pennsylvania time warp. But if anyone feared that he was going to scrap the place, they needn't have worried. "It was like the model railroad I never had as a boy," he said later and on many occasions. The East Broad Top, the oldest operating narrow-gauge railroad in the United States, had been rescued. Kovacic went on to offer train rides to the public and tours of the rail yard, sharing a rare bit of history-rich Americana with thousands of rail fans. Even after Kovacic died in 1977 and his son Joe took over, volunteers continued to assist with track work and train maintenance. Families rode the rails on holiday outings. The belt-driven workshop thrummed as skilled Wright machine locomotive wheels repaired couplings and fabricated valves, crossheads, and connecting rods. The depot, always thronged with day trippers, sold tickets, toy t-shirts, and chotskis. The place hummed with energy. But by 2011, the railroad faced overwhelming financial obstacles. The numbers just didn't add up anymore. The train rides stopped, but the years rolled on. The rail yard lay dormant. Rot ate at the building's foundations. Mice and squirrels nested in the gloom of the blacksmith shop, and shagbark hickory saplings sprouted between the red oak railroad ties. The East Broad Top, a National Historic Landmark since 1964, was once again on the edge of extinction. But this time, there was no Nick Kovacic waiting in the wings. Central Pennsylvania is rippled by the rugged Appalachian Highlands, a hardscrabble country of tough, religious mountaineers. Poverty defined the lives of the early inhabitants, but riches were to be found, some above the earth, others below, specifically timber and coal. The East Broad Top Railroad, or EBT, received its charter to operate in 1856, with the goal of reaching the coal fields and thick forest on Broad Top Mountain, some 30 miles southwest of the railhead, through rough terrain. The Civil War and a dearth of financing, however, delayed construction until 1872. The line was built as a narrow gauge, the better to handle the curves and steep climbs of the surrounding mountains. Standard gauge width is 4 feet, 8.5 inches. The East Broad Top narrow gauge is 3 feet. The EBT won the contract to carry the U.S. mail to and from the small settlements along the route after it added passenger service. An expanding logging business also contributed to the growth of the young railroad. The Old Estee, as it was affectionately known, built an extensive rail yard in Rock Hill Furnace, about 10 miles from the railhead at Mount Union, for train and track maintenance. Over the years, the EBT added machine shops, storage sheds, sidings and yard tracks, paint and blacksmith shops, a sand house, and a roundhouse. The complex was actually able to construct its own freight cars. In 1874, the EBT tracks reached Robertsdale, a flyspeck of a sloping settlement with an abundant seam of semi-bituminous coal. New iron mines were being carved from the mountains along Black Log Creek, not far from the rail yards at Rock Hill Furnace. A blast furnace was built there in 1876 to take advantage of the increased iron production. That blast furnace needed coal, lots of it, and the East Broad Top knew how to carry coal. For the next 80 years, the EBT conveyed customers, toted limber, managed the mail, and carted coal along its 33-mile length. But to everything there is a season. Iron products dropped out of fashion with the widespread adoption of the Bessemer steel process in the late 19th century. By 1908, the furnace at Rock Hill was obsolete. In the ensuing decades, the growth of abundant oil and natural gas increasingly shedded coal to the wayside. After World War II, coal use sputtered and faded like embers in an unstoked furnace. The need for a feisty, narrow-gauge railroad to haul the shiny black hunks of fuel from the mountain mines diminished. The East Broad Top's denouement was being played out. The 1950s were especially sorrowful years for the old Estee. In 1953, the post office began carrying mail by truck. The EBT lost the federal contract and, as a result, stopped carrying passengers. And then the final gavel rang out. The railroad filed for abandonment in 1955. The EBT's massive Mikado No. 17 steam engine made its final run to the main line at Mount Union on April 6, 1956. 3 weeks later, the entire operation, locomotives, rolling stock, offices, equipment, roundhouse, station, the whole kit and caboodle, was sold to Kovalchik Salvage Company. Fast forward 55 years. In 2011, despite the Kovalchik family's passion and efforts, the old Estee once more faced financial failure without a savior in sight. I'm passionate about trains. When I learned that the East Broad Top Railroad, eastbroadtop.com, has been rescued yet again and has its first full steam ahead season in 2023, I make plans to drive from my home in New York's Hudson Valley to Rock Hill Furnace, 275 miles away. There, I meet Jonathan Smith, the line's marketing director and himself a former steam engine fireman. He's outside the station, busily selling tickets and making a concerted effort to get one-time pressed visitors to take a tour of the rail yard in addition to the train ride. "We're a small organization," he explains. "What is someone with a lofty title of marketing director doing selling tickets? We all have to wear a lot of hats," he tells me. The organization is the nonprofit EBT Foundation, which, like Nick Kovalchik all those years ago, swooped in to rescue the East Broad Top Railroad from its ignominious finale to its long and storied history. The group, whose backers include a former Amtrak CEO and other well-heeled rail aficionados, presented the plan to revive the line to Joe Kovalchik in 2019. He liked what he saw. On Valentine's Day 2020, the foundation completed its purchase of the rail yard, along with 27 miles of the original 33 miles of track. None of the six engines were in condition to be used. The tracks were overgrown and under-maintained. Buildings needed to be restored. Some even needed new foundations. But the biggest job that lay ahead was the restoration of the railroad itself. "We had to replace 10,000 ties," Smith says. "We had to do all the brakework and mechanical work on the engines. We had to raise buildings out of the ground to stabilize them. We evaluated all the engines and felt that number 16 was in the best shape." The first operating year in the foundation era was the abbreviated season in 2020, but without steam. "We did a very limited one-mile run that August," says Smith. "In 2021, we used a diesel on 3 miles of track. In 2022, they added more passenger cars, and in future, the plans are to refurbish and use the full 27 miles. The foundation finally reintroduced number 16 in 2023, making it our first full steam ahead year of service," says Smith. Note to all rail geeks, number 16 is a 282 Mikado steam locomotive built by Pennsylvania Baldwin Locomotive Works in 1916, and for which the original EBT paid $16,000. I'd hope to see old number 16 in action, but on the day of my visit is scheduled for maintenance, so we've pulled by the M7, a muscular, chunky-looking General Electric diesel center cab built in 1968 for Algoma Steel of Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. I'm introduced to Larry Fox, our engineer, and I ask if his compartment on the M7 is comfortable. Somehow, I've always imagined train engine interiors to be rough but cozy, with cushioned seats and maybe a pot of coffee keeping warm on an electric burner. No, he says with a laugh, there aren't any springs in the seat. It's noisy and bumpy, but that's all right, he says. I like it anyway. The train ride is short, just 4.5 miles each way. Mostly, the views are of farms, fields, and forest. Inevitably, though, life in the 21st century pokes through. A new strip mall can be seen on the highway that parallels the tracks part of the way. A Colgate Grove, marked by a large stand of trees, soon to be enhanced with a pavilion and dining area, we turn around for the trip back. In the future, passengers will be able to disembark here for a picnic and return on a later train. We motor past a stretch of open pasture land known as Ferry's Farm. The calming view of tall, waving grass is backed by rolling green hills. Nearing the depot, we pass through the tiny borough of Rock Hill Furnace. This town is generational, says Smith. Their dads worked for the railroad. Their grandfathers worked for the railroad. This railroad has been part of the life here for 150 years. I enjoy our train ride, but I'm just as fascinated to tour the rail yard with its curious buildings, odd heaps of smoking ash, and overwhelming sense of yesteryear. The wonderful thing about the East Broad Top, Smith says, hopping over sidetracks and veering around gravel piles as we head to the works, is that it's frozen in time. Turning back the clock is part of the Foundation's goal. Plans for expansion are focused on reopening the line to the southwest, past the country villages, through the disused mountain tunnels, and up the steep climbs towards the old coal mines, eventually directing the trains to the very end of the narrow-gauge tracks in Robertsdale. The 21st century doesn't intrude much in those parts. We aren't sanitizing it for you, says Smith as we walk around the deserted yard. We aren't ever going to remove the grit and grime. The old non-working steam engines are stored in a mechanical station called a roundhouse. Just outside, on a giant turntable, number 16 is going through its routine 30-day safety and upkeep inspection. From the roundhouse, Smith leads me to other buildings, a carpentry shop, the freight office, the old stone house. The shop buildings, or portions of them, date from the 1870s and look every bit as old. The machine shop is the most evocative of all. Dozens of ancient contraptions, lathes, drill presses, planers, punch and shears, sheet metal rollers, cutters, mills, and tools that aren't even manufactured anymore, are activated by a Rube Goldberg-like cat's cradle of leather belts and line shafts running overhead and down to each individual apparatus. You're standing in what is the largest belt-driven machine shop in the country, says Smith. There are others, but none are this large or intact. Onward we go, exploring. Suddenly, I'm 12 years old. Mark Orwell is a journalist, lifelong train buff, and author of the new thriller Cross Purposes. His work has appeared in Condé Nast Traveler and Town and Country, among others. For more, visit markorwell.com. And that's all the time we have for today. This has been Kay Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post. Good night.